The next case for argument this morning is the estate of Kylie Sanborn et al. Versus Mark Peterson et al. Appeal numbers 30857, 30872. Arguing on behalf of the plaintiff appellants, John Burke will take the will be arguing initially in the opening, and then Michael Schaefer will be taking up the rebuttal. And then arguing on behalf of the defendant appellees, Justin Bell and Robert Anderson, is at council table. With that, Mr. Burke, you may proceed with your argument.
Thank you, Chief Justice Jensen. Good morning. May it please the court, Mr. Bell and Mr. Anderson. Attorney Mike Schaefer and I represent and have the privilege of representing Sarah Sanborn, who is the personal representative of the estates of her two daughters, Kylie and Jana Sanborn, who were killed in an accident on U.S. Highway 281. For the benefit of those in attendance today, although I know the court is familiar with the facts, I'll briefly touch upon the facts and how we arrived here today. Kylie and Jana were traveling north on U.S. Highway 281 in November of 2019. In an area where there's a slight curve in the roadway, their Chevrolet Impala traveled just past the fog line on the right-hand side. The shoulder that they should have proceeded onto was not there. Instead, they encountered a drop-off of 5.5 to 7 inches. The right side of the car dropped dramatically. The drop was such that the undercarriage of the car was actually scraping on the roadway. Kylie attempted to steer the vehicle back onto the road. Moments later, the vehicle climbed this drop-off and shot across into the southbound lane. A truck driver who saw Kylie that day said she looked scared to death and was holding on for dear life. Unfortunately, the girls ultimately had a head-on collision with a southbound pickup, and they both perished. Factually, there's really no debate that the 5.5 to 7 inch drop-off is a hazardous condition and in need of immediate repair. Mark Peterson, the Aberdeen Regional Engineer for the DOT, admitted that. We're here because of two legal questions that have to do with immunity and duty. Specifically, we're here to talk about whether the defendants are immune from suit on the basis of sovereign immunity, and then separately, whether the defendants are effectively guarded from liability or culpability because there was no duty under the public duty doctrine. In this case, the circuit court ruled that there is no sovereign immunity shielding liability. However, the circuit court did rule on summary judgment that there was no duty owed to the Sanborns under the public duty doctrine. And so respectfully, the appellants have appealed that circuit court's rulings. When I get into a brief discussion of the public duty doctrine, because I intend to talk about both, because the sovereign immunity issue was raised by notice of review by the appellees, so I'll talk about both. But I think as a framework to start with, we have to remember Justice Koningkamp's words in Tipton 2. In Tipton 2, he said, quote, "In carrying out our responsibility to ascertain duty, we must ponder the nature of the government's relations to its citizens and ask to what extent it should and can tolerate accountability for the negligence and misdeeds of third persons." So the public duty doctrine, in terms of its evolution in South Dakota, it was first applied in Hagen.
This isn't really a third person case, though, is it?
No. Absolutely, Your Honor. And I intended to drive that point home, but I appreciate the court bringing it home. This case is unlike almost all public duty doctrine cases in the sense that if you look at the evolution from Hagen, where it was adopted, and then in Tipton, they said, hey, we're not going to have a bright line standard here. And then in Riley, what they did is they said, we're going to narrow the public duty doctrine to effectively law enforcement and the ambit of public safety.
Well, but would you agree? I mean, if we apply the public duty doctrine here, it would be an expansion of anything we've done before in terms of the public duty doctrine. Would you agree with that?
Did you say an extension?
What's that?
I didn't quite hear the end of the question.
Okay, so my question was, if we apply the public duty doctrine here, it would be an expansion of any time that we've ever applied the duty in the past. Would you agree?
Absolutely, Your Honor. The Chief Justice.
And let me go on. And that's where we've applied it. is really two instances. One where there's the state, we've held the state should, or someone's claiming the state should have prevented a third party from doing something, or a public safety function of some sort of thing. Or you might say, I think of it as police power, law enforcement, zoning regulations, things like that. We've never applied it in the highway context. Would you agree?
100% correct, Your Honor. Law enforcement and public safety, and if you go through the cases all the way from their origin, they generally fall into two camps. Code enforcement is a recurring theme that comes through in Hagen and Walther. The other line of cases, if you will, all the way from Tipton, where the wolf dogs mauled the little girl, to the case in Lawrence County, where they thought the sheriff's deputy should have busted up a party where a minor was assaulted. They always fall in those two categories, but the common theme, and Justice Kern pointed this out in the Fodness case, the common theme is always a third-party actor, whether you're calling it the ambit of public safety or law enforcement. Justice Kern, you noted in Fodness, which was where the apartment building collapsed in Sioux Falls, quote, the duty to ensure compliance rests with individuals responsible for construction. Permit applicants, builders, and developers are in a better position to prevent harm to a foreseeable plaintiff than our local governments. And that's consistent with that theme that runs through in all of these cases. The opposite happened in the Maher case. Basically, the facts of that case are the allegation was that the city of Box Elder had turned up its water pressure and water mains were breaking in a mobile home court that Maher owned. And this court did not apply the doctrine there and said, quote, this court has never held that the public duty rule automatically applies whenever a plaintiff brings a negligent suit against a governmental entity. In fact, we have previously recognized that a governmental entity may owe a plaintiff a specific duty arising out of general principles of tort law. And so to circle back, Chief Justice Jensen, to your question, it's never been done, and it would expand the doctrine to a place it's not gone before. And respectfully, that's what we think the circuit court did. And we think it's problematic for a few reasons in addition to that. First of all,
how's that different, if I could? How is it fundamentally different from code enforcement?
How is highway maintenance?
Yes.
It comes back to the language that Justice Kern used in Fodness, Your Honor, because what we have in code enforcement is those are third-party permit folks, developers, code enforcement officials. And so there you have code enforcement officials expected, if you will, to keep an eye on third-party conduct. In this case, we don't have a third-party actor. The Sanborns are asking for nothing more than for the DOT to be held liable for its own conduct. It has exclusive control over the maintenance of this highway and shoulder. So we're saying the DOT should be found to answer for its own conduct, just as any other tortfeasor has to answer for those.
But even if you win on public duty, you've got another big hurdle.
Yes.
You talk about sovereign immunity.
Yes. And very briefly, if I could, in addition to extending the doctrine, it would be inconsistent with the whole purpose of the public duty doctrine because there's no third-party actor. But also, if you apply the public duty doctrine in this setting, you have a problem because you're effectively abrogating the statutory duty to maintain highways, and you would be affording the equivalent of absolute immunity going forward for the DOT to maintain our highways.
So can I ask you about that? You cite 31-5-1, Department of Transportation shall maintain, keep, and repair all highways in the state. Is it your argument that that statute alone waives sovereign immunity for the department?
I think I would answer it like this. It's a mandatory duty, so it uses the word shall, but that statute, defendant employees or state actor employees are not immune from ministerial tasks. And I guess the statute is aligned with the policy letter where they drill down and they say, hey, here's what you need to do. And that's where the immunity ultimately is waived. I mean, it is a statutory obligation.
So if I'm understanding you correctly, that statute places the duty with the state, but to get around to establish it's ministerial rather than discretionary, there's got to be a set standard that the department has to comply with.
Right. And I think that's come through in earlier cases from this court. I can't cite the opinion off the top of my head where they said, well, the statutory duty is exceptionally broad. And within it, you know, you're overseeing hundreds of potential employees and what they're doing. And so the applicable standard or the ascertainable standard actually comes from the policy letter that's implemented by the DOT to fulfill that statutory obligation.
So what's the established standard here that the department was required to follow in this instance?
I would direct the court to the policy letter titled Shoulder Maintenance. The purpose is to provide the level of service to which types of highway shoulders are to be maintained. And it doesn't say may be maintained, but are to be maintained. And if you go to the second page of that policy letter.
Is that the OM 2002-09?
Yes, Your Honor.
Got it.
And so there's two documents that are going to be talked about today. The first is the policy letter referenced by you, Justice Salter. What comes beneath it, there is a performance standard, but before I get to that, is this area of the road was unique in the sense that it had gravel shoulders on 281 for about a 12-mile stretch. And there's a separate paragraph, it's the fourth paragraph down on page 10 of that policy letter that says gravel shoulders shall be maintained, so there's no room for judgment or discretion there, by blading and adding material as necessary to essentially preserve the original template section. Existing gravel shoulders shall be maintained in design condition. The evidence was conceded by the witnesses when they were deposed with the DOT that the original design condition had these shoulders effectively flush with the highway. And so that ascertainable standard comes from that policy letter.
I want to talk to you about that. So I understand the argument about an ascertainable standard, and I understand the argument about its relative, you know, definitive nature. But doesn't the definition of a ministerial duty require more than that definite ascertainable standard? It has an executory component to it. It's not just that you have this standard and it's clear and you know what it is. We described it as recently as McGee is an absolute certain imperative involving the execution of a specific duty arising from fixed facts or the execution of a set task imposed by law, defining the mode, the time, the mode, and the occasion of its performance. So it's not enough to sort of say there's this aspirational goal that we're going to have flush shoulders, right? That to be ministerial, it has to be crystal clear as to the time, mode, and occasion. How you do it, what you do it with, and when you do it. How does that map onto this case?
I would respond to that this way, Justice Salter, is also in McGee, this court noted, quoting from Wolf versus Sense, quote, once it is determined that the act should be performed, subsequent duties may be considered ministerial. Later on in McGee, this court said, an act that is ministerial will still require the actor to use some discretion. And so what we have is we have the separate performance standard that the defendants point to, and it gets into some of the issues I think that the court is talking about. But as the court said in McGee, the mere fact that there may be some discretion ultimately down the line when you're fulfilling your task does not subvert or trump the fact that it is a ministerial task that is required to be performed, which in this case is clear in the policy letter.
How do we apply that rule? There can be some discretion leaking in here or there down the line, but if there is an overarching standard that expects a specific outcome, then everything is ministerial, even though there's a little bit of discretion leaking in here or leaking in there?
Well, I think
it's tough to apply.
I think, Your Honor, it comes back to at the end of the day, no matter how specific you laid out a task, when gentlemen, workers, females are out in the field performing the task, there invariably will be some measure of discretion that will befall upon them. But it can't undo the fact that they are required to do that task that's statutorily maintained. And it should not be lost on the court that here we have a separate ministerial duty that is presented. The first one arises from the policy letter. here. But we've argued that separately, because this court had pointed out that you can have a ministerial task that is a product of experience. Okay? And that happened in this case. We deposed Mike Heeb with the DOT, and he testified that he deemed the appropriate standard to be for him to drive the roads in his unit area weekly. And this court has made clear that you can have a discretionary, a ministerial task with a reasonably ascertainable standard can come from the product of experience. Okay, and that was in Wolf versus Sands. And so separate from the policy letter, we have this DOT official saying, I have developed this standard. It's reasonably ascertainable. You need to drive the roads weekly to see what's going on out there. And so that's a separate standard. And he described that it was weekly. He described what he was doing. And that was the product of his experience. And Wolf said that that is another manner in which a ministerial duty.
So if his replacement, his successor says, yeah, I don't think it's a week. I think it's 10 days. And implements a 10-day rule, then he's deviated from the ministerial task.
Well,
set up by his predecessor.
I guess I would circle back to this, and I would say if his successor in that role made the decision, I'm going to change the standard, if you will, and adopt this being the appropriate standard, because you got to remember that this wasn't effectively taken sort of from the wind. If you go to the policy standard that the defendants rely upon on page 2, for scheduling an inspection, number 3 says routine inspections will identify the needs. And so that's the standard I believe that they developed at that unit level to correspond to when they need to do routine inspections.
It also says, the performance standard says, the maintenance supervisor or their designee shall retain the authority to modify or deviate from this performance standard within their discretion based on experience or judgment. Seems discretionary.
That seems to be the defendant's argument, Your Honor, but the problem is I keep coming back to Wolf versus Sens and McGee in paragraph 37. Once it's determined that the act should be performed, subsequent duties may be considered ministerial. You could go to a world where you're essentially saying that every single task would have to be spelled out with such precision and shalls that the person in the field would have no room to make any decision whatsoever, including maybe how many coats of paint to put on something. And I think that deviates from the underlying purpose when we're looking at sovereign immunity. This court...
And your red light's on, Mr. Burke, so you need to wrap up.
Very sorry, Your Honor.
No, you can finish up. Finish your thought.
Justice Salter, it requires an individualized inquiry, not a mechanistic approach. And the goal is, and we got to remember, this court has said highway repair is generally considered to be ministerial in nature. They also have pointed out, at least in McGee more recently, that one of the considerations in the background is there a strong likelihood that serious harm will result to the members of the public if it's performed incorrectly. And that's something to keep in mind. At the end of the day, Justices, this isn't a policy-making decision that happened here. It wasn't a judgment call where the workers sat down in a field office and decided, we're going to debate when to fix this. That's not this case. That's not this case. This is not a policy or discretion type case. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Bell, you may proceed with your argument.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Justin Bell. I'm an attorney from Pierre. I represent what I'm going to refer to as the state employee defendants in this action. As was discussed by the appellant's counsel, the trial court granted summary judgment to the state employee defendants. But at the trial court level, the state employee defendants, or the appellees in this case, raised two distinct theories as to why summary judgment would be appropriate. Those issues were, one, that under the court's sovereign immunity precedent, the state employee defendants are entitled to sovereign immunity. And second, the state employee defendants, or the appellees in this case, argued that under the public duty doctrine, state employee defendants are entitled to summary judgment.
You won on the official capacity summary sovereign immunity claims in the trial court.
That is correct. There's
so
not a
the
lot
stuff
of
in your brief that talks about official capacity. We can that doesn't matter.
Your Honor, I would agree with that. I raised the 2 pages of that just because I didn't know exactly what was going to be said in the reply brief. Notice of review, you don't necessarily see where that's at. I think that's been not argued by the appellants in this case, and it was resolved in our favor at the lower court level. And so I don't plan on addressing that before the court today as relates to sovereign immunity. Of course, that's different, and it's a different analysis when you're dealing with individual capacity claims. That's when we deal with the court's traditional ministerial and discretionary function analysis. That analysis is longstanding, goes back to roughly 1896, I think, is the first time the court talks about discretionary duties versus ministerial duties, and develops over the next 125 years, roughly, in this case. But I think the real issue here is when looking at the issues raised by the plaintiffs, is there a ministerial duty or is there a discretionary duty? And we would simply state that this is a discretionary duty. And I'll state to kind of follow the arguments previous to this, that they are distinct, both the sovereign immunity and the public duty doctrine, but I think the public duty doctrine is usually viewed as complementary to sovereign immunity analysis, and so that's why I'm going to address that first. Appellants in
You're
this
addressing
case,
sovereign immunity first?
Yes, Your Honor. Said.
So I want to ask you this. So our case is going back to at least Hansen, 1998, have said, we've held that highway repair is generally considered ministerial in nature. However, highway repair and maintenance functions will be considered discretionary, except sovereign immunity when they involve actual planning, design, policy decisions, or actions not subject to an established standard. So we're really talking about that last piece. This is not design. This is not planning, any of that. We're talking about actions not subject to an established standard. Would you agree with that?
I would agree with that. I think there are times where the appellants confuse design standards into this, but yes, I agree that the correct standard to apply is that.
So the policy letter, South Dakota Department of Transportation's policy letter, says gravel shoulders shall be maintained by blading and adding material as necessary to preserve the original template section. That seems to be an established standard the Department of Transportation has a duty to perform. Would you agree?
I believe that it is a standard. I don't think it's an established ministerial standard, if that's what the question is.
Okay, and so why is that not ministerial? That's my question.
Thank you, Your Honor. I appreciate that. I think for 2 reasons, maybe 3. One is, I think there's a confusion about what the term existing gravel shoulders shall be maintained in a design condition means. So that would be the second sentence in the third paragraph. I think what that is saying and how it should be interpreted is the maintenance is supposed to be, when it's done, it's supposed to be to the design standards. You don't get to change the design standards through your maintenance. And so if you're maintaining it, for example, in this, I don't think there is a disagreement with the appellants on the fact that the design standards were that they're supposed to be a flush gravel shoulder to the paved road. That's not disagreed with. And when maintenance is done, the goal of the maintenance is to have the design standard be met, okay? But I think there's 2 reasons why that doesn't create a ministerial duty under this court's precedent. One is the second sentence in that paragraph needs to be read in combination with the first sentence that has the word essentially preserve in it, which, of course, isn't that established. That's certainly far more ministerial and far more discretion in it. But I think most importantly is what's in the statute is the fourth, excuse me, I said third, it's the fourth paragraph, the one that the court just referred to, and it's the fifth paragraph or the following sentence here that says, shoulders are to be maintained in accordance with the above guidelines using applicable standards for the work being performed. So what that sentence is saying, the following sentence is, we have these, what I would say, lofty policy goals for what's going to happen, but the actual meat of what you're supposed to do is in the performance standards.
So we're short 6 inches of gravel on this drop-off, and your view is there's no ministerial duty to go in and repair that.
Thank you, Your Honor. I think the answer is yes, and I think it's for two reasons. One is, I think it's important to note that there's no evidence that DOT actually saw or was on notice of the fact that this condition existed. There is some evidence presented by a couple of neighbors who said that they noticed the area was there.
Does notice matter?
It does to the public duty doctrine. It does regarding the special duty analysis.
I mean, there's that 3132.10 statute out there. It makes a couple of appearances in the briefs, but doesn't really get a lot of traction.
I think the answer is no, in reality, Your Honor. Even if the state was put on notice, I don't think it would change based off of the language in the duty. Now, I would say that it is possible in some cases where notice would, because if you had a specific function that said, and this happens in DOT, if it was within the roadway of travel, you know, where we're talking about is not the legal lane of travel, and there are maintenance issues that says if you get put on notice of something in the legal roadway of travel, you have to fix it within X amount of hours.
Yeah, I mean, the reason I ask is that's what 3132.10 says, right? I mean, if you're and we've interpreted that case in Hagen, I'm blanking on the name. We've interpreted that. We've kind of said that statute has discretionary components to it, but the time requirements look pretty ministerial, right? As you just said, I mean, you get notice what it was damaged because of a arson or a flood or some other cause. So I think we've decided that the other cause is discretionary. But what it requires is pretty ministerial. Within 48 hours, you got to get out there. You got to warn, and then you got to fix it.
Yeah, I think that statute, Justice Salter,
it's not in this case, but it just kind of maybe.
I don't think that statute necessarily applies to this case, as I think you just stated, because it's not within the legal lane of travel as relates to it. But I think more importantly, in this case, in Function 2158, the timing is explicitly dealt with, and that's in the second page of Function 2158. That would have been Trial Court Exhibit 11. And it says for scheduling an inspection, states that gravel shoulder maintenance is not an emergency, it's not of an emergency nature, and should be scheduled, meaning that you don't have to do it when you're put on notice. And then directly after there, sub 2 under scheduling inspection says that this work should be performed during moist weather conditions if possible, which is part of the issue that we had here. It was moist earlier than it froze as relates to this. It's not the time where you would normally do maintenance of such repairs because it's going to leave. There's a dispute of fact, although I think that this dispute of fact doesn't change the analysis in this case. There's varying witnesses that say that they went out and put gravel after the accident, but it dissipated shortly thereafter because it was cold. It was winter. Gravel, you can't pack it after that. It dissipated when vehicles went off the road in the course of time thereafter. And so I don't know if notice matters except, one, I think that there's a notice provision in the rule, but that notice provision is discretionary in and of itself.
So all the notice and, you know, whether they should have done this or some should have done that, that really gets into the question of negligence in my view. Getting back to the question of whether their duty here was ministerial or discretionary, you know, I'm looking at 2158, and I understand the argument. It talks a little bit about that, you know, no question there's some discretion here for the department as to when they do this, how they do it, things like that. But that doesn't necessarily diminish the standard, does it, that gravel shoulders have to be maintained? And so if there's that established standard and there's some discretion built into that, doesn't that tie right into our cases that there is an established standard and generally highway maintenance is considered discretionary?
It's ministerial.
Or ministerial, I'm sorry.
Your Honor, Justice, I do not think that it does, and I'll give some examples. I think there's really two main cases where this court has found a discretionary duty and did not apply sovereign immunity analysis in a maintenance case. That is Wolf, and it's in McGee. in those cases both held in the cases, in the situations where the court did not apply sovereign immunity, there was a very specific standard in play. In Wolf, there was a standard that would be akin to the performance function standard that said during a certain weather event, you needed to go salt the roads between 7 a.m. and, or excuse me, 5 a.m. and 7 p.m., excuse me, during that time frame. And then after 7 p.m. until 5 a.m., it was discretionary. This court reasoned that based off the fact that it was a non-discretionary, very specific duty regarding the salting and graveling of roads between the time frames involved, and the fact that it said that it's discretionary after the fact, and it's not discretionary between 5 a.m. and 7 p.m., that's a ministerial duty.
So I think it's immediacy. So, McGee, only shoot so much tack oil as you can get to in a day, nothing more.
Correct. And in fact, it's important to remember McGee did apply sovereign immunity to several aspects of that case unanimously. And I think this case is far more similar to the signage aspects of McGee that involved should language. This court found was essentially not mandatory, but just best practices or guidance to it, and far less like in McGee, where it was the same thing. The holding for the one issue where the court did not apply sovereign immunity in McGee, it was an if-then statement. You must make a calculation, and you must only do that much. That's not in these standards. If this court were to expand its ministerial duty analysis to include any time that there's a policy that says you shall maintain roads, there is not a single road case where the maintenance case where this court could ever apply sovereign immunity because of the statutes that are involved. This court has never done that. And I think, in their briefing, the appellants argue at length that there's essentially five different ways that there's a ministerial duty. The first two are the standard maintenance and federal law requirements for it, specifically SDCL 3151 and then 23 USC 116. They're just, you shall maintain the highways. I think an oral argument here, appellant's counsel conceded that that's probably not enough, and I would agree with that. This court has never found that the generic requirements for the state to maintain the road is enough to waive sovereign immunity. And I would simply say that that's not the case here. Similar with the Green Book and design guides stuff that they mentioned too, as relates to this.
I'm going to turn your attention to the public duty rule and why should it be extended?
Thank you, Your Honor. I'm glad that you said that. I would submit that it's not an extension as a starting point. I will concede, as I did at the circuit court, that this court has not ever addressed that before. There's never been a DOT case that the majority of the court has adopted. I will state that in Bland 2, Justice Konenkamp, who wrote the Tipton 2 decision, explicitly stated that is potential for the public duty doctrine to apply to highway maintenance cases. And he specifically cited Knutson versus Hall, which is a Rhode Island Supreme Court case, and said that this court should explore what exact application it would have in this case. I think there's two main reasons why the court should. Is one, this falls in line with the generic duty question about whether or not this is a duty to an individual or to the public. And I would submit that highway safety, under the theories that are presented by the plaintiffs in this case, is public safety. I also do think, I think I'm glad that the court asked a lot of questions about the Third Party Act. I don't think that's a necessary. This court has never held, although the cases have been third party perpetrator cases that primarily have been addressed, it's never held explicitly that that's a requirement of the public duty doctrine.
Well, but in South Dakota, there are a number of jurisdictions outside South Dakota that have said those public duty cases apply to third party control.
I would agree. And I would agree that the public duty doctrine case law throughout the United States is extremely varied. Yeah, there are some that say that it doesn't have to be a third party perpetrator. There's North Dakota, which has abrogated it altogether, and there's a kind of a slew of everything in between as it relates to this.
I agree. It's all over the board.
Yeah. But in this case, I do think there actually is the evidence of a third-party perpetrator that actually would apply. I know I'm out of time, but I would just say the reason why we had the loss of the gravel is because multiple people were driving off the road and causing the problem. There's testimony cited too by the appellants and the appellee about the cause of it being that people were driving off the road and leaving the gravel off the shoulder, I think that would be the quite frankly, the third-party act that would create the problem that would meet that standard. But with that, I thank you for your time and appreciate your consideration of this case. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. Mr. Schaefer, you can proceed with your rebuttal argument.
May it please the court, counsel. At the outset, the picture is worth a thousand words. Exhibit 18, which is in, it's the last page in our appendix, Appendix 46, shows the condition of that road taken a day after the accident. There was approximately a 6-inch drop-off that extended for 200 to 300 feet. And you can see from this photograph that it follows that area where the road curves. Now, before I got into this case, I never heard of pavement edge drop-off or that it meant anything to a layperson. But it means something to officials in the transportation industry. They were well aware, based on the AASHTO standards that they had seen and based on their own experience, Mark Peterson testified, that creates a hazard because if a driver's wheels go off of that and it tries to climb up or get back on the pavement, it'll shoot them across into oncoming traffic. That's a dangerous hazard. Mark Peterson said, when I showed him these pictures, he said that drop-off was a dangerous condition in need of immediate repair. Mr. Heeb, the problem is we're all looking at this standard and they fell down completely on the job, on doing their job to inspect this highway. Mr. Heeb testified that his experience, and it can be based on the product of experience, is to inspect these roads once a week. Terrence Peck also inspected them once or twice a week. Jeff Boomsma, who lives a mile and a half from where this happened, a farmer, submitted an affidavit that said this condition, as shown in this picture, existed for approximately 1 year before this accident.
Does that make it more ministerial, less ministerial, more discretionary? There's no discretion
when you have, according to their own Mark Peterson, the region engineer, when you have a dangerous condition that's in immediate repair, in need of immediate repair, there's no discretion. You look at this.
So then it wouldn't matter whether it was there for 24 hours or a year?
Well, that's not, the 24 hours isn't this case. This is our case involves the facts that show that it was there for an extended period of time.
We're going to have a rule that talks about discretionary and ministerial duties, and that rule will be more durable than the result in this case.
Well, the rule is in the policy letter that it shall be maintained flush with, or in the original design condition, which is flush with the pavement. Now, you said in your questions to Mr. Burke, doesn't this require execution of a task imposed by law prescribing the time, mode, and occasion? I read that quote out of McGee. It specifically says, a ministerial act is defined as absolute, certain, and imperative, involving merely the execution of a specific duty arising from fixed designated facts. Or, the execution of a set task imposed by law, setting out the exact time, mode, and manner. Or, here we have a specific designated fact that we have to keep these shoulders maintained. Now, if this was a half inch down or whatever, we wouldn't be here. But under their approach here, basically they're taking the position. They turned a blind eye to the condition of this road for approximately a year. Mr. Heeb would have supposed, I asked him, why didn't you see this? And you know what his answer was? Well, evidently, I didn't look at that portion of the road for 52 weeks.
And that, I understand, goes a lot to the question of negligence. If they have a duty to breach their duty, you have to acknowledge 2158 has some discretion built into it in terms of when, how the department does these repairs. How does that fit into whether this is a ministerial or discretionary duty when they've got some discretion?
In this court's opinion, in Chief Justice's opinion in McGee, he basically said there may be discretionary components of any ministerial act in the performance of the ministerial act.
So you might use the example of we've got a statute that says state employee, they go over the speed limit. Hard and fast, you get a ticket for that, or if you hit somebody and you're going too fast, you don't have immunity. There's also, as a part of that statute, it says if you overdrive the conditions, so it's raining hard, there's ice, something like that, there's some discretion built into that. Does that mean there's sovereign immunity under that statute?
No, absolutely not, because it's a ministerial function to maintain this road, and to ignore it and basically say. And I would point out Justice Salter's argument. This sounds discretionary to me because it allowed the maintenance supervisor to retain
an argument. I was just asking
to maintain authority to deviate or modify. We took his deposition. Mr. Heeb testified in his deposition that he never modified. He never delegated. There were no other of these.
There's another part to that sentence too that says modify or deviate based on specific weather conditions, road conditions, or other events which may impact.
He testified there,
any evidence of that?
There was no evidence of it, according to his own testimony. So basically, this is consistent with what footnote 7 in the McGee case said, where they argued, well, the engineer had discretion to override these requirements. And as Chief Justice said in that opinion, that never happened. So you can't just say because there's discretion written in here, it never happened, and therefore you can't use that to justify what happened here. What they're doing here is they're trying to seek refuge in this performance standard to absolve. They're totally falling down on the job and not observing this condition. They let it go for approximately a year to the point that it had gotten to be a 6-inch drop-off, which was a severe danger to the traveling public. So they get to say, well, wait a minute, I got a performance standard here that says the word should in it, therefore I'm home free. I don't think the law, and I don't think the law on distinguishing discretionary and ministerial is so mechanistic or formulaic that this court will turn a blind eye to this condition that cut short the lives of these two young women and say, well, we got this other statute that says.
You need your time's up, Mr. Schiff.
Okay, thank you. I just think this is a travesty because it's an accident that could have been prevented if they would have done their job. They would have done their inspections, and then if they would have done maintenance. If we're going to create a situation where any time there's any discretion, maintenance is optional, then our roads aren't going to be safe for anybody. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, counsel, for your arguments. We'll be in recess till about 11:35.